Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply.
Welcome to the Trish and Sarah Wrestling Podcast. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Trish.
And this is our podcast. We're talking about wrestling news and various topics from different promotions, primarily AEW, but also New Japan Pro Wrestling, WWE, and other topics from around the wrestling world, whatever we find interesting, and we hope you will too. And we wanted to take a second at the start of the podcast to thank everyone who listened to our first episode and gave us feedback, and all of your kind words were so wonderful, and we really appreciate it. Thank you all so much. So without further ado, we're going to get into it for this week. Usually like to say when we're recording, which is Monday the 2nd of October. So we got a chance to watch or at least read about Wrestle Dream last night. Trish, I know you had things going on this weekend that prevented, plus the massive time difference, which I'm always so admirable. I admire all of the Brits and the Europeans that are on top of the pay-per-views when they come out, because midnight alone and I'm exhausted the next day. So, but yes, we had Wrestle Dream last night, which was by all accounts a spectacular show. I really enjoyed it, and ended with the big surprise. So, spoilers: Adam Copeland, the former Edge, showed up at the very end of the show. And is now full-time in All Elite Wrestling. And that was pretty much it. Tony Khan really pushed the new era of AEW, but it seems like what he meant by that was that it was Edge arriving. So it was not necessarily a letdown, but I think it's another one of those situations where Tony Khan tends to over-promote something a little bit and gets people's imagination sort of get carried away a little bit. And then we end up with something very cool, but not what everybody sort of thought it would be. So, Trish, what are your thoughts about the former Edge?
Do I have to give myself away as a former big Edge fan? I probably do.
Why not?
Yeah. So the thing with Edge is, you know, it was a great moment and it was really good for perception. So there's been this kind of feeling that kind of traffic was all going one way. So we've seen the impact of Cody. This last week, we've seen Jade move across and then celebrate it in a big, big way. So this is whole thing of AEW's on call, nobody wants to go there, everyone's leaving, there's trouble there all the time. No one's going to want to come to AEW, and this kind of breaks that mold. So whatever you think of Edge in terms of his business performance, in terms of his age, he is a star. You know, he's a former WrestleMania main eventer, a WWE Hall of Famer. And it just changes that. And, you know, he's going to have big appeal to TV networks as well.
Yeah.
Whether, you know, so the name, in effect, does change that. I think it's really interesting. I think that he's using the Rated R Superstar name that they were able to trademark. But it's kind of twofold. So it's useful because it connects into his former name without being able to use the trademark name Edge. But also it kind of dates it.
Yeah,
really back to the mid-2000s. So when, you know, Edge had the heel turn and the run against Cena and the first kind of mini title run, and then later with the runs on SmackDown. So it does kind of date it into the middle 2000s. So it was kind of twofold. But I guess you've got to do something, and at least you got to keep the iconic music, which he kind of had from Alter Bridge rather than WWE. So that was pretty easy for them to get hold of. Great pop in the building, kind of a great moment, and they made a big deal out of it. You know, we complained about not making a big deal out of like Jay White signing and other big signings when you really want to say that things are changing. So it was really good to see them actually make a big deal out of it on the show and then at the press conference.
I thought it came across great. I think it was a little bit, in some ways, it took me back a little bit to All Out 2021, where you kind of were like, okay. And, you know, yet again, Christian in a main event where everyone's like, all right, when the match ends, something's happening. But it was, you know, it was fun for him to come out. He was clearly having the absolute time of his life. And, you know, I thought the angle was great. And they've already got him doing a promo segment on Dynamite on Wednesday. And then he's got a match on Tuesday against Luchasaurus, which I think is spectacular. And you pointed this out right away, Trish, which is it's for Tuesday, which is the day they're going up against NXT. And NXT has been pushing, or they've been pushing main roster stars on NXT. And this is one of those things that could get people to tune in when they have to move their, when AEW Dynamite has to move its night rather than going up against a WWE show moving their night. But yeah, I thought it was great. I thought it was a good end. I thought everybody sort of expected it, but it still went over well. And like you said, the music was great. You know, the name as much as they can. I'm probably going to just start calling him Cope. I don't know why. I probably should be able to handle Adam Copeland. There's a lot of Adams now in AEW. It was the Adam Elite Wrestling.
We'll live with that. We'll live with that.
I thought last night's show, and I think AEW in general has just been on an incredible run of pay-per-views. If Double or Nothing 23 is, you could argue, is the least good, the most of the quality level at the bottom, it's still an incredible pay-per-view and probably tops some of their earlier pay-per-views that they've had. So just an overall fantastic show last night. I thought the individual matches that were great were absolutely spectacular. I thought there were a couple misses and some low points. And I actually had a really interesting conversation with somebody today about the difference between this and All Out and which one was better. And I was sort of arguing that this one was better. And he was sort of arguing that All Out was a better show top to bottom. And I don't know that I disagreed with that. I think the individual top matches in this pay-per-view were better than the best individual matches in All Out. But I thought All Out in general was a tighter, better overall show. So there was definitely some downtimes during this one. The Yuta Ricky Starks match didn't get a lot of audience reaction. The FTR Aussie Open match also was in a tough spot. They were, you know, after the trios match with the Golden Lovers and Jericho and the Callis family, and that was a hot match. So, you know, and I do think, you know, it's extremely difficult to recreate a match that everybody loved. And I think that was a tough task that these guys set up for themselves, was to recreate a match that was extremely critically acclaimed last year at Royal Quest, right? I'm saying that right?
Yes.
Yeah. And I think they had a tough road to hoe. And unfortunately, Mark Davis came out of it with a broken wrist. So Aussie Open could be on the shelf for a little while, which is unfortunate. But hopefully Kyle Fletcher will get some singles matches and we'll see.
I think it illustrates as well when you see matches like in a series that are really, really good, how difficult that is.
Yes.
When you see a match like, you know, FTR and Aussie Open not deliver up to that standard. And, you know, people even said the similar around FTR and the Bucks and All In wasn't up to the standard of their previous match. So it is so difficult to go out there and match your previous standard, let alone beat it. I think the interesting thing when it comes to, you know, with Edge coming in is, and we, you know, we're looking at the pay-per-view lineup that we had last night, is that he's going to be on every pay-per-view, right?
Yeah.
At least at first, he's going to be on every pay-per-view. So that is a slot similar to the way that we have with Punk that kind of is removed from everybody else. And the big thing with him will be, you know, will the value match kind of the opportunities given? So, you know, you mentioned him, Tony saying that he's going to be on Dynamite and then Collision and then back on Dynamite for Title Tuesday. And you want to get as much as you can out at the start because, you know, look at when Bray Wyatt returned.
Right.
Unfortunately, no longer with us. Look at, you know, when Punk first came in, when Danielson first came in, when Cole first came in. Then first few weeks is when you're going to see that kind of ratings impact. And then it falls away and they become, you know, you'll figure out what level he kind of sits at. And, you know, the interesting thing when I think about Edge's return in WWE was that you had that initial kind of the big pop at the Rumble, and then it didn't really kind of translate into TV ratings. Yeah, so there was a famous one, actually, when he went on NXT against AEW, where it did a 0.16.
Yeah.
In fact, I think it was his name for a little while. people harshly called him a 0.16. And also, you know, they weren't doing well for WrestleMania, so they ended up adding Daniel Bryan to that match and making it a freeway. So you know, his, and his drawing record, I mean, he ended up with the spot he did in WWE because he had a very successful kind of mini run in with the world title in January in 2006. And then, but then he was always kind of the secondary champion over on SmackDown. And there was no huge ratings impact, no huge kind of ticket impact. And they really need kind of jolts in that direction. So with, if you're going to invest that amount of TV time and you're going to invest that amount of kind of just promotion, really, then you do want to see kind of that value come back from him. Because, you know, when you've got a guy like Adam Page playing like the Kingmaker, doing the kind of role that Danielson used to play in WWE, of being the guy kind of elevating others, when, you know, maybe that's more what some of the guys coming in from WWE at that age should be doing. You know, so, because, you know, he's still not fully elevated himself. So, yeah, it's all about how they use him and how much value it's actually worth, and not overusing him over others that they should be promoting and pushing higher for me.
Yeah, I don't know. I think AEW has done a very good job with veterans in general and older guys. I don't think that for the most part they're pushed outside of what they should be. I thought Christian especially has handled perfectly, you know, in terms of his TV time, what he's doing with his TV time, you know, how he's interacting with the rest of the roster. Like, that's, you know, if Edge can come in and do something similar to that, then I think that will be beneficial to everybody. You know, I don't know that, I think most of us are not looking for a 35 to 40 minute Edge singles match as a main event of a AEW pay-per-view, but I don't think we're going to get one either. I think, you know, it'll be interesting for Edge and Christian to feud with each other until they stop feuding with each other, at which point they'll probably tag team together, and then we'll have some kind of a brief tag team run, because I'm sure they want to do Edge and Christian against the Young Bucks and Edge and Christian against FTR and like all those kind of matches that everybody sort of talks about. So, but yeah, from a business perspective, I think it's worth discussing, you know, how things ended up with Wrestle Dream. Where they ended up, based on Dave Meltzer on Wrestling Observer Radio this morning, said they were 7,500 people in the building last night for WrestleDream. It did not say whether or not the numbers were for paid or unpaid. I did not get a chance to look at WrestleTick, so I'm not sure about that. But that's a pretty decent jump from where they were earlier in the week. I think they were down just a little above 5,000. Brian Alvarez also had an interesting conversation about this, where he said he talked to a lot of people in the building who had to pick one or the other. They either went to Collision on Saturday night or they went to Wrestle Dream on Sunday night. You know, tickets were expensive and people didn't want to commit to two nights, which I thought was pretty interesting. He also made a point of saying that the Collision taping on Saturday didn't end until 10:30 Pacific time, which would have been 1:30 Eastern time, which is insane for a TV show that ended at 10 p.m. But, you know, that seems to be what's going on with the Ring of Honor tapings now. And I know we talked about that a little bit last week in terms of that sort of hurting that it's, you know, needing an audience so late into the night. In terms of pay-per-view purchases, Meltzer, and this came from Tony Khan in the press conference last night, he did indicate that they had done better than the All Out pay-per-view purchases, which I think are sitting at like about 95,000 right now. So it looked like there's about 100,000 pay-per-view buys for WrestleDream. And I think this is worth discussing in terms of, and I don't want to get away too much from the tickets because I think that's also important too. Too many topics. But we're looking at, in the last 5 weeks, and this is a conservative estimate that I put together based on, you know, estimates that we have from Meltzer and others, is that we're looking at about 365,000 pay-per-view buys between All In, All Out, and WrestleDream. And if you compare that to the best previous pay-per-view purchase, which was All Out in 2021, which did 215,000 pay-per-view buys. So that's 150, at a minimum, 150,000 more pay-per-view buys in a month than their best previous month, which I think sort of shows that the additional pay-per-view experiment, it probably isn't going to go away anytime soon. So I don't know what you want to tackle first, Trish, the pay-per-view sales or the tickets, as I aggressively talk my way through both of those topics.
No, it's all good. No, so we'll start with the, I'll just go in order. So in terms of the ticketing, yeah, they kind of shot themselves in the foot. And I know people say, oh, they've done, you know, double tapings and things for pay-per-views before, but there's been quite a subtle difference. And most of them have been taped with Rampages in the past, other than the All Out pay-per-view and the Forbidden Door show. And the key difference to that is that the Friday nights have kind of been smaller crowds, but they've been more localised, and then people have flown in for the show on a Saturday and Sunday. This one, there's no fly-ins now. So if you're going to do more pay-per-views, your fly-in audience is going to pick and choose. You know, the only real fly-in show this year, I think of, was Forbidden Door.
Right.
So there isn't that kind of audience flying in that's going to, oh, you know, I'll tack something onto my experience. You really are then using just a local crowd, and then you are splitting them.
Yes.
And yeah, and they were running, you know, 4-pack deals for Collision of, you know, $15 tickets each. They were running a very high get-in price until midweek for Wrestle Dream, so it was $55 midweek, eventually dropped to $35, which is more in line with the get-in price for Full Gear, which they priced perfectly. You know, that's the reason there's 8,000 tickets already out for that show.
Right.
And then, you know, we talked a little bit about it, but in terms of back-to-back nights, then what you really need is some kind of combo deal, some kind of offer that allows you to see both shows for a set price. And this didn't happen because Collision went on sale way before WrestleDream. So then it left it vulnerable to start. And then by discounting Collision so heavily, and I get it because you want to look good on TV, but then you left your pay-per-view now as, you know, the second lowest attended pay-per-view outside of the COVID era behind Full Gear 2019. So you can't have everything. And I get it. They say it's cheaper to use the same building for the two nights. The loading costs are cheaper and hiring the venue is cheaper than moving it from one area to another. But it just doesn't look, or the perception isn't good enough. And we've had this before. You know, we discussed it last year, the tour that we discussed last year, where the logistics were, they saved a ton of money, but it didn't, it was in cold buildings and it didn't look great.
Right.
So it's all about what you prioritise. And what they did in San Francisco might be a better option, you know, where they ran the Cow Palace for Dynamite and for Rampage, and then they moved to the Chase Center for the pay-per-view. So it gave that pay-per-view a kind of a big feel. And you really do want that. Again, it's all about perception. Look how many people look at numbers and quarter hours in a week. So you've got to change that perception. You've got that idea that you're a hot company, that you're something to invest into. And then your metrics kind of go with that. I think that's not too dissimilar for all live events, you know. Why is Taylor Swift so big? Oh, because everybody wants to buy them tickets and them shows, they all sell out. It's in demand. Once something is in demand, it becomes kind of essential. So, yeah, they kind of shot themselves, I think, a little bit in the feet with that.
I think it's clear in the way that they've re-strategized for Full Gear, which you sort of touched on, and how they're releasing, the way they release the tickets for that, the way that they manage the pre-sale, the way that they've managed the shows around it, have just been sort of overall better than, like you said, they had this Collision booked, whether they didn't plan to do WrestleDream, whether it was a last minute thing, it seemed like it was, you know, they had no combo tickets, and, you know, people weren't flying in for this one. Now, do I think there comes a period of time where more people fly in for different pay-per-views, depending on what the card is? I think, you know, if you're somebody who's been a traditional AEW pay-per-view goer, where you're like, okay, once or twice a year, I'm going to fly to an AEW pay-per-view, you kind of have a rhythm in terms of when you know they're happening, right? And in some cases, where? You know All Out's going to be in Chicago. You know Double or Nothing's going to be in Vegas. So you're kind of like, okay, I can plan for this. But the way that they've been sort of announcing these pay-per-views, the way they announced WrestleDream kind of last minute, it didn't really give you an opportunity there. Like you said, you're relying entirely on a local audience. But I don't know if that's something they can change in the future if they decide to do this kind of stuff regularly.
No, it probably isn't. If you start to do kind of more regular pay-per-views. And it's funny because on the press conference call, he kind of didn't commit to the 12 pay-per-views that had been rumoured. He talked about kind of 8 to 12 rather than definitely committing to 12. And maybe that's a better number, you know, because in terms of pay-per-view buys, so you mentioned the figures for the combined all-out, all-in WrestleDream totals. You know, so traditionally they were so kind of doing 5 a year. And say you're doing 140,000 for 5, you're kind of looking, that takes you to kind of 700,000 buys. If you're doing monthlies and you're doing like the rate that WrestleDream is currently at, so between 100 and 110K, and you're doing kind of, I don't know, 8 of them, you know, you're looking between 800 and 900,000. If you're doing 12, you know, you want to kind of be targeting 100K. So if you're doing more, they're going to earn more. And the whole thing, I know people talked about it going up against the NFL and lack of title match, but a lot of that just comes down to frequency. So right. I don't think you can expect to do 12 and think that you're going to do 140,000 for each. I just don't think that's manageable in this day and age.
That to me was one of the things that in listening to Dave Meltzer this morning, I was kind of like, all right, you know, he fully, and whether he, it's certainly possible that he would have qualified his comments more, but he seemed to lay the blame for, quote unquote blame, for there being only 100,000 buys at the fact that there was no title match, which is certainly could be a factor, but the fact that they had three $50 pay-per-views in the last 5 weeks feels like a bigger factor to me, just in terms of like, I got to spend all this money, you know, it's not an insignificant cost when you're talking about, you know, there's no, certainly obviously if you live outside of the U.S., you have Fight and that's cheaper, but, you know, inside the U.S., it's $50 and that's it, you know, and I think that to me seems like a bigger deal than the card itself, or I think we've seen that AEW has a base level audience that will watch whatever. And I think that's, you know, what we saw last night.
Yeah, I think it's a couple of different things there. So, you know, people point out that Forbidden Door did 140K after Double or Nothing did similar. And the thing, well, slightly more than that, but the thing with Forbidden Door is that it has its own kind of identity. Right. So although, whilst this was like an Oki tribute show, I wouldn't say that it had a unique identity. You know, it didn't feature too many people that were unfamiliar with in AEW. So I felt it was an AEW pay-per-view. It may have had a theme around an Oki, but it was an AEW pay-per-view.
Well, and everybody who knew anything immediately looked up what the New Japan schedule was and figured out who was going to be available and who wasn't. So, like, your hardcore fans knew that there were going to be some matches that you weren't going to make. Like, okay, we've got Ospreay, we've got Zack Sabre Jr., we've got a few other guys, but you're not getting anybody else.
Yeah, and, you know, the key thing kind of going forward as well is we don't know what these pay-per-views are going to look like next year.
Right.
So could they be on Max, as in streaming similar to Peacock? I think that's kind of unlikely, to be honest, because of the kind of the Max model. And the wanting to do more pay-per-views is to get a higher share for WBD and hopefully for their perspective, to centralize it so, you know, it's not being shared amongst the TV providers or
right.
other streaming services. Other big thing around that pay-per-view number as well, and you know, the second biggest market for pay-per-views is in the UK, and that pay-per-view was advertised well in advance to be on ITV4 on our kind right. of free-to-air, one of our linear networks on Thursday. So if you've got a choice between paying for that show or waiting 4 days and there's nothing, you know, must-see, or, you know, you could see Edge, to be fair, if you wanted to see Edge's kind of arrival, you could watch it on YouTube. Right. And then wait for 4 days to make sure you have matches. So, yeah, you've got a kind of a big change in distribution in your second biggest market.
It's just fascinating to me because, like, as we're talking about it, I'm thinking about the fact that I still think of those four, and it really should be five because Forbidden Door is an annual event, but I still think of them as being, like, the four big pay-per-views. And, you know, at this point, that's kind of dead. You know, we're probably going to have another one in December, it's been discussed, although the question of whether that's an AEW pay-per-view and a Ring of Honor pay-per-view seems to be up in the air. And I would not be surprised to see something in January, given that we don't, you know, that stretch between Full Gear and Revolution is usually the longest stretch without a pay-per-view on the calendar. So that wouldn't shock me either. And, you know, my first question was going to be like, well, is this going to impact, like, are they ever going to go back to doing 140K regularly again? But probably not, unless they get something really hot going.
The other thing is, as well, is, you know, at some point you've got to look at, if they are going to do AEW pay-per-views a year, what is the value in additionally running the Ring of Honor pay-per-views?
Right.
Yeah, so if the Ring of Honor pay-per-views are doing kind of 20 to 25K maximum, but then your AEW pay-per-view is doing 100 to 120K, surely it makes more sense to just run them as AEW pay-per-views, no AEW branding, and actually gain that money rather than running a pay-per-view. You know, if you could run that on streaming, if you could get a deal for Ring of Honor to run, you know, their big events, their pay-per-views as part of Max and the kind of sports tier, then great, that might be a much more efficient option. But I just don't see what the value is in continuing to run Ring of Honor as a separate pay-per-view on an already flooded kind of pay-per-view market within the one company.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got that many pay-per-views going for AEW, I'm going to be certainly less, you know, part of the appeal for me for Ring of Honor pay-per-views after AEW bought it was that AEW had so few pay-per-views that I was like, hey, some of these matchups are going to be great and I'm really into them. But that's not going to be the case, as you said. You brought this up last week, which I thought was fascinating, is that you noted that a lot of the Ring of Honor belts were going back to bigger AEW stars. And we could talk a little bit about Rampage Grand Slam. And the fact that the Hung Bucks won the Ring of Honor six-man titles. What do you think's going on there? Talk to me about what you think the situation is with Ring of Honor right now, because it seems like something's going on.
Yeah, I do think they're chasing, you know, some sort of deal and wanting to kind of increase the value of Ring of Honor as part of that package. Yeah, so at the moment we talk about Ring of Honor having kind of less than 10,000 subscribers. That seems to be the line on that. But they seem to be very focused on Final Battle in December, you know, doing a really strong number. And they think that adding, you know, the likes of Eddie Kingston, the likes of Paige and the Bucks is, and then having MJF and Cole or MJF and whoever that might be about that point in aiding that. The only thing I would be concerned of in that is, are these people going to be featured on weekly TV? He says it, but we're not seeing it yet.
No.
Is it going to increase that subscriber base? You're only going to get that if you offer them on that TV. And then you've then got the thing of, will that pay-per-view be the December pay-per-view, or will there be an AEW one as well? So will you flood the market in that month? How successful it will be is quite interesting, because you look at NXT. So NXT is doing huge numbers some weeks, being first on cable, on others, you know, the putting kind of the main roster stars, the Becky Lynch, the Rhea Ripley's, the Dominic Mysterio's, it's helping their numbers. And yet, you know, Shawn Michaels does a press call this week and says, oh, you know, NXT should probably be on a younger, hipper network, kind of saying that USA probably aren't valuing them. So if NXT isn't finding value in what they're delivering, it makes me wonder how much value is actually in Ring of Honor.
It's such a weird situation with Ring of Honor, because it really does feel like a snap decision that it's like, well, let me buy this and we'll figure out what we're going to do with it later. And I still, you know, at the time was like, oh, this is great. And now I'm kind of like, I think this was a mistake. I think there's always value in the media library, obviously. But I think in terms of, you know, the way that they've set up the tapings, we talked about this last week, but the way that they set up the tapings, the way they got rid of Dark and Elevation, and obviously that wasn't because of Ring of Honor, that was because of WBD's exclusivity deal with them. It just seems less important in some ways. In some ways, Ring of Honor feels less important than Dark and Elevation did, in terms of like stuff happening, which feels terrible because there's wrestlers doing phenomenal work on Ring of Honor. You know, like you see like Athena is, you know, having a fantastic run, but like you said, 10,000 people are seeing it.
Nobody's seeing it.
It's kind of a bummer.
Dark and Elevation, you know, is at least over 100K a week.
Right.
Seeing it on each show. Yeah, nobody's seeing Ring of Honor. So it doesn't matter, unfortunately, it doesn't matter how great the work they're doing on there if nobody's seeing it. And then you have these characters coming on to AEW television who have had no exposure even to that fan base. And then people are doing the, you know, the Who Are You chants and things like that at live shows. So, yeah, I don't see a great value in it right now. Maybe I'm wrong. Well, I guess we'll find out on that. I think there's an interesting thing coming up as well. So you've got, there's two sets of tapings where Rampage and Collision are being taped together.
Yeah.
So we will see if Ring of Honor moves to being taped before Dynamite on them 2 weeks, starting the week in Oakland. And then if not, then we'll see if that moves back to a more of a studio setting and we stop doing tapings to 12:30 at night, which is just, you know, and that's an awful way. You want to end a show on a high. You don't want, you know, half the crowd gone by about the Ring of Honor match and 400, 500 people there by about the 14th. So that will be quite an interesting thing to keep an eye on in terms of the future layout for ROH television.
Well, and it's also fascinating as it relates to NXT too, right? Is that if NXT ends up where, you know, they get a renewal deal or Ring of Honor gets on Max, do you have these folks sticking around, right? Like, does Becky Lynch still coming down to do an NXT taping? Is she still the NXT Women's Champion? Probably not, I would think. You know, are the Hung Bucks going to be doing Collision Ring of Honor tapings, you know, till 2 o'clock in the morning to be the trios or the six-man champions? Probably not. So is that kind of like a bait and switch that your audience is also going to be aware of on both of those sides? Some interesting things to look out for as regards to both of these properties and how they fit into the bigger picture of both AEW and WWE and their rights renewals and what they want to do with this. You know, I think there's really kind of some echoes of they each have sort of the same problem a little bit, although I think obviously NXT is a bit more, well-founded. I don't know what to tell you. I was up very late last night.
They're on a bigger platform,
yeah,
and they have more kind of visible kind of results and more things that they can point to in terms of their value. So it does make sense that they're in a stronger position, but they are kind of mirroring each other now in strategies. The ROH title holders is exactly a mirror of what's happening in NXT, for sure.
Yeah. Okay. So the other thing we wanted to talk about and touch on in terms of ticket sales was something that we brought up last week, was local promotion and the impact on ticket sales. And for Grand Slam, I guess it's about 10 days ago now, they did a tremendous amount of local promotion right before Grand Slam. We had MJF at Mets games. We had MJF on multiple local news stations. We had Chris Statlander and Orange Cassidy doing media rounds. We had Anthony Bowens and Adam Cole and Britt Baker at the MLB Network. And as a result, they ended up doing about 2,000 tickets in the last week or so. And correct me if I'm wrong, Trish. It's about right. And then on top of that, they did a phenomenal rating for Grand Slam. Like, the best number they had all year. And it's hard not to think that some of that local promotion, because New York is such a big market, didn't also impact the show and how many people watched it. But it was interesting that we had that whole conversation about how little local promotion they generally do. And then they did a bunch of it and sold a ton of tickets. So one of the other things about Grand Slam that I think is interesting as it touches on ticket sales has to do with the build for an actual title match, which we talked a little bit about last week in terms of how in previous title reigns, Moxley especially, Hangman also, they had used the title defenses as a way to rescue underperforming houses or potential locations. So I think this was a one where you could probably argue this was the same.
Yeah, absolutely. So you had a very much more, as you said, traditional kind of build to it. Although the kind of the Better Than You Baby stories was involved and the stuff with Roderick Strong was involved, it wasn't the lead. So the lead was the interactions between Max and Samoa Joe, and Samoa yep. Joe looking like a killer through the tournament. And it worked. You know, that show peaked in that main event. So, you know, for people who kind of question Max's value, you know, that number, and yeah, we talked about it, you know, it didn't have as much competition, and we'll see what he does against competition potentially next week. But it delivered that number with that kind of more traditional title match. And I think, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing to look at in terms of now, especially with the unfortunate injury to Adam Cole, is
yeah.
what do you do with that story and what do you do kind of with the world title?
There's a few things about this that I find fascinating, and you touched on it a little bit, was, you know, they did have a phenomenal number, and if that number was based around local promotion partially, you have to give some of that credit to MJF for going out there and selling the match and selling the show, which I think is important to do because I think he's getting a lot of criticism right now in terms of how the AEW is performing with him as champion. And I think there's some valid criticism in there, but I think some of it's a bit overblown as well. At the same time, like you talked about, with Adam Cole being out, that brings up a lot of changes that I think are going to happen with this program. And there's a lot of places they can go. And this is one of these things that I always find fascinating because I love to talk to people I agree with, but I also really like to talk to people I disagree with. And you and I are not on the same page with this program, or have not been on the same page with this program, which I have enjoyed tremendously. And I think last night was the first night that I was like, okay, this could be a little bit different. And I sort of started to see where you've been coming from with some of your criticisms, which I think are valid. I think for me, so just to kind of quick give a summary for those who weren't able to watch, hopefully you have watched the pay-per-view by now. With Adam Cole being out injured, they discussed on last week's episode of Dynamite relinquishing the Ring of Honor tag titles, but MJF said no, he wanted to win them in a handicap match. So he did a two-on-one handicap match against The Righteous, which was a pretty straightforward comedy match. I think Brian Alvarez would call it a house show style match. That was... I kind of compare it to sort of a bag of Haribo gummies in that I enjoyed it very much while I was watching it and then afterwards felt a little sick. But I was kind of like, oh, this was good. It was well put together. It was well done, but I don't know that I liked it in terms of where it's going. And I don't know that I want to see it again, I guess would be the best way to describe it. So the big questions are, you know, obviously Adam Cole has broken his ankle in multiple places and torn a ligament. So the odds of him being back anytime soon are not strong. I think we're looking at him being out for months, at least in terms of his ability to wrestle. So does he come back just to be an on-screen character who doesn't, you know, wrestle but is part of the storyline? What does this do with the storyline as far as Roddy Strong and the Kingdom go? Because Adam Cole from last week seemed to disappear with both the Kingdom and Roddy Strong. And then the Kingdom, at the end of their match against Best Friends on Saturday's Collision, said they were going to rejoin him at the hospital or something like that. So, there's a lot of things. There's a lot of moving pieces to this angle that are impacted by Cole not being around, even if he does come back.
It's one of them things. So I think the big thing is because the world title's involved here. You know, that's the big difference maker. And it's not like... So if you think about it, right, and these are other companies, but these are the comparison points. So if you look to New Japan, you know, if that was Okada, he wouldn't be in some tag slot opener. He'd be in that main event with that title. So there's an expectation from people that come from that fan base. And even if you look at, you know, people compare it to the Bloodline and Roman Reigns. But when Roman Reigns has been doing tag team matches, where he teamed with Solo Sikoa against Owens and Zayn for the tag team titles, or when he teamed with, you know, when they did the Usos one against him and Sikoa in the Money in the Bank, the key things were they were the main events, they had big stakes on the line in terms of how they build up, and they were the ones, they drove interest in that show.
Right.
So, you know, there was a quote from Max in an interview at the weekend where he talked about, you know, Dark Order match. And, you know, he talked about, you know, people saying they don't get it. And then he said, you know, people bought the pay-per-view and then they heard the reaction during the match. Did the crowd sound quiet? And it's like, that's great. But how many people bought that pay-per-view for that match? You're the world champion. So if, you know, they're not doing the pay-per-view numbers or the ticket numbers for that pay-per-view that they want, is that world championship delivering in that range? And we've spoken so much about how the world championship has been protected, how it's been used to drive ticket numbers in AEW. But it's also been used to drive pay-per-view sales. And neither of the kind of the Dark Order match at the pay-per-view, as much as I love the Dark Order, and the Righteous match have driven pay-per-view sales. So are you undervaluing him? Are you using him in a worthwhile spot? You know, especially when, you know, people are looking at your business and saying it's not as strong as it used to be.
Right. It's a fascinating conundrum for me. There's a catch-22 involved, and we've talked about this before. I like that they have given the opportunity to the TNT title and the international title to main event pay-per-views. I think it opens up main events to people who wouldn't have had those opportunities before. I think it makes the shows a little bit different and kind of gives them a different flavor. I think if I'm seeing the same main event title defense every single pay-per-view and we're doing monthly pay-per-views, I'm going to be sort of bored by that after a while. That said, and you brought up a valid point last week, that should be the tag titles. Why isn't the women's title main eventing? Like there's other things they can do there that I think are important. I do feel like, you know, Jesse Collings did a very good podcast episode recently with Trevor Dame, and they talked about how it was a punk related podcast, but they talked about how most wrestlers are now wrestling fans and they grew up as wrestling fans, and none of them want to be Shawn Michaels. They all want to be the good guy. They don't want to be the politicker and the backstabber and the guy who has to be number one. And I think it seems like there is a point of pride to some degree with MJF that he wants to work with people and give people opportunities. But I don't know that that's helping the company overall. And I think that's kind of an interesting piece to this. Like, you know, as you said, he's their world champion. And, you know, I don't know that I need to see him beating tag teams in a handicap match. I would rather him just do a singles.
Yeah, so look, you know, he doesn't have to be in the main event. We've had, you know, matches in the semi-main event with Jericho and Cody, you know, with Brody Lee and Jon Moxley. So they don't have to be in the main event, but a strong, you can't tell me that a strong match for Max with somebody else that was well built, or, you know, a match for the tag team championships, if you, you know, if that's the road you wanted to go down, wouldn't have been stronger or wouldn't have done better or added more value than what they did on the pay-per-view. And, you know, and the terms of beating kind of guys 2-on-1, I hate that. I detest it.
I hate it. You know, I hate
just,
it.
You built the Righteous up and then you just made them into a comedy joke act. You know, that's a proper Triple H 2004 thing. And, you know, the other thing with that, which I just can't deal with. So when the company started, there was this focus on tag teams having value, right? So you had Hangman and Kenny Omega teaming. And the first time they teamed against an actual tag team in Pentagon and Phoenix, they lost because they weren't a team and that team was stronger than them. This is now one man beating two. So you've kind of lost that philosophy. Right. And that's the kind of thing that worries me more, I think.
I just don't, you know, they announced the match and I was like, I would have rather seen MJF team with Roderick Strong. I would have rather have seen them do something a little bit more interesting. I just felt like you almost could see it coming when they announced it. And it was like, oh, this is bad. You know, I think they need to get out of it. I think they need to pick a heel team that they want to elevate. And I think that heel team, you know, pardon my language, needs to beat the shit out of MJF. Because I think by doing so, you could get him over as a face a little bit more. Like, there's some opportunities there. It's just, it's gone. It's funny how this has gone from being something that I was unabashedly really enjoying to something that I am, like, a lot more wary and unhappy about in a very short period of time. I do think removing Adam Cole from the equation changes things quite significantly. And I think that's part of why I'm sort of like, well, they probably could bring him back, because I just, I don't know. I think that impacts the way that it goes.
The thing about this story is that the longer you leave it running and you don't do kind of bigger things with your world title, or you do challenges to your world title that are kind of a side piece to this, is that you kind of stop other people's momentum.
Correct.
So, yeah, we've seen it. Yeah, you know, we discussed it. There was an interesting tweet from Trevor Dame last week about Orange Cassidy, and it kind of set the world on fire a little bit. But the point is that you can't gain momentum in this company and have something to go for. So say if you, for example, with Cassidy, if you lose a mid-card belt after a big reign, you tend to go sideways into a kind of a big feud, or you'd want, or the Gedo method, the New Japan method, is you fall upwards. So then you'd kind of look into the world title. You can't do that here. Yeah. No. We've now got the same thing with Swerve. You know, and I know that program's going to continue with Hangman. But, you know, could he now challenge for the world title, or would it be all wrapped up in this kind of thing? So there's that kind of stepping block, that kind of upper way to go up and kind of keep the momentum, is just not there with this at current. You know, it puts a ceiling on everybody else. And I'm not sure kind of how helpful that is. So this kind of changing is not bad. I'll tell you what the other thing, though, I wanted to ask you about, and especially because you're far more, we've said it, you know, you're far more invested in this story than I am, is, you know, you've currently got MJF running this kind of face dynamic, but still kind of teasing the kind of bidding war of 2024 stuff. And, you know, does that mean that he's going to be saying, I'm going, and kind of as the baby face and kind of threatening the company with that?
So this is...
That's on the spot, you know?
Oh my God. I cannot handle another... And I realize that I am one person talking as one person. I can't fucking stand the shoot freaking storylines. Like, can we do a kayfabe storyline and just do... And part of that's part of why I appreciated this freaking stupid Better Than You, Bebe. It existed solely in kayfabe. There was no shoot elements to it. It's just a wrestling story. And I am so sick of it. If I have another person give a promo where they talk about how their opponent is more liked by Tony Khan, I am going to throw something at the television. I'm fed up with it. It goes for everybody because they're all doing it. And it's dumb. Please, and Tunnel Talk Podcast goes into this in so much better detail than I ever could, but please create a motivation for your character that is beyond just, I'm held back. It's so overplayed, it's so overdone, and the best way to put yourself in the spotlight and do something different is to not do that. But now I've completely forgotten what you asked me.
No.
Because I'm ready to start ranting.
You know, before, you know, you look at it, that's where the Samoa Joe character was so successful in that short build, right, that it wasn't about, like, oh, I'm, you know, not given these opportunities. It's just like, I'm going to kill you.
Oh, the bidding war of 24.
And I'm going to kill you.
He can't do a bidding war of 24. And that was the thing that made me very happy, because I think it's very clear at this point. I would be, personally, and maybe I'm wrong, I would be shocked if MJF has not signed some kind of long-term extension or a deal after he came back last year. Maybe he hasn't, but it would certainly be something that I'd be surprised by. But regardless, I don't want to see it. I don't want a storyline based around him potentially leaving the company. I don't want the company to be a heel promotion again, where the person that everybody loves and the character that everybody cares about and the wrestler that everybody wants to leave, right? Why on earth would you do that? Why? You went from AEW being the home of professional wrestling and having Bryan Danielson give an incredible promo where he stood up and said, everybody wants to be here because this is where wrestling is, right? And now you're going to have one of your biggest stars be like, I'm out of here because, you know, yada, yada, money. Like, if he wants to be a face, this cannot be a storyline. It just can't. It makes absolutely no sense. It doesn't work. And it would just be a huge, huge mistake. They would be way better served by just abandoning it completely. And I don't think, like, I think there's certainly some places you could go from a standpoint with some of this stuff that I'd be interested in, right? I thought it was fascinating that they threw Jay White in the mix last week. And that seemed to me to be kind of like a stopgap, like, hey, our plans changed. We have to do something different. We're going to need a singles match, you know. And maybe it was the plan all along, but I was kind of more interested in that than anything else. And I think I'm looking forward to that because I think when you have wrestlers whose styles are drastically different, you get something really, really good and interesting. And I think MJF and Jay White do have very different styles in terms of how they give promos. And I don't know that they fully meshed last week, but I also feel like it wasn't like, oh, this is terrible. Get it off my television. I don't know. Does this stew of words make sense to you, Trish?
Yeah, no. So, you know, you've heard my opinion that I wasn't as high on the JY-MJF exchange as others were. But I found it was because it was very cliche. There was a lot of catchphrases. There was a lot of kind of cheap insults. And I want to see more from them. You know, JY, I've been watching JY for years and years and years. And he can kind of get to really good depth in his promos and the way he changes kind of his voice and how he performs. And I didn't quite see that. But my hope is that as these progress, you kind of get more of that development. And that match, you know, this kind of comedic face stuff that we saw, it was frankly a kind of very kind of Hulk Hogan 95 stuff that we saw from MJF this weekend. Sorry, but it's true. But, you know, you're not really going to be able to do that with Jay White, and especially because he's playing more of a comedic heel character as well. You know, he's not in a serious kind of vicious heel face that we've seen in parts in New Japan. So, yeah, that's going to be interesting to see how both characters develop. But for me, it's just, I want to see that as the centre of the story. And okay, yeah, you're going to have everybody else involved. You know, we saw the sneak attack thing and everyone identified Roderick Strong Roderick Strong's neck brace even. But I'd like, for the moment, depending how Adam Cole is, how long Adam Cole is out, is for that to be the kind of side story and the focus to be on the building up of challenges. So we can get Jay White challenge and whatever happens there. We can get the next challenge, depending what happens with Swerve and Hangman, probably will produce the next challenger there. So there's this progression of challenges and this progression of things happening in the main event, and the main event becomes more of an exciting part of the show. Because, you know, you look at the pay-per-view here and you look at the pay-per-view All Out, and is anyone going to remember anything that Max did on these shows?
No.
Seriously? They're not. No. They're not. And that with your world champion, to me, is, you know, that's the issue. So I want to see it become kind of more traditionally focused. You know, he talks about a more traditional style. Well, let's have kind of that more traditional kind of world champion bit in this regard.
I think while I want to be upfront about what I'm not liking about it, because I'm not liking it, I think I want to also be realistic and understand that, like, it's entirely possible that they had to switch gears and come up with a new angle in the course of like an hour and a half, given when Cole hurt himself and when that four-way tag actually started. And that can't be an excuse, but given the Moxley injury and some of the other stuff, I think it's fair to say that there was some last-minute wrenches thrown at the way they were handling this. And, you know, the show in general and the promotion in general has felt so much more focused since All Out, and the build to Grand Slam, to Wrestle Dream, you know, they're building to shows not just this week, but the week after. It feels so much more coherent and so much more structured that I'm actually, while I'm pointing out something I don't like, I'm really optimistic, if that makes any sense.
No, absolutely. And, you know, this is one of the things that you can look at. The fact that they were able to slot Jay White in so easily is a testament to how they've built Jay White since he has arrived. You know, he may have started slowly with Ricky Starks, but they've been able to progress him through the summer to the point where you stick him in there in that position and he doesn't look out of place. And that's not always easy to do.
One of the benefits of the type of booking that they do and the stop-start momentum that we talked about, right, is that you do end up with this sort of solid base of upper mid-carders that you need very little work to get them and put them in a position. You need, like, what, 2 weeks to get them in a position where they could credibly, you know, challenge for this belt. Now, is that better than elevating a couple people to the absolute top of the card and building some other stars? I don't know that it is, but in this instance, it does kind of give you some flexibility.
And it's more difficult then for them to do so, because you've got Jericho at the top of the card, you've got Moxley at the top of the card, you know, they're not really moving, you have Max at the top of the card, you have Danielson at the top of the card. Whereas it's easier to look at WWE and see what they're doing, because Roman's not always around.
Right.
You know, the guys like Moxley and Danielson and Cole, you know, they left to go to AEW, so they created this vacuum for other people to be able to be elevated into. Whereas in terms of TV time and pay-per-view spots, there isn't always that same kind of opportunity in AEW. It's much more difficult because you've still got to keep your stars on TV. You know, you've got to keep your ratings up. Right. So you have less opportunity to develop, especially at this time with TV contracts on the line. And, you know, Tony talking about not wanting to do kind of a 6 to 9 month trial on Max suggests maybe that TV deal isn't as close as we thought it was. So it's even more critical that they use the people that are important to them. But yeah, so you do have that element of not being able to progress as quickly, and people compare that. So they look at WWE and say, oh, you know, LA Knight's come through and had this huge thing. You've got Rhea Ripley coming through, Dominic Mysterio, which I'll never understand why he's so over, but he is. You know. But yeah, so it's a completely different environment. And when, you know, Trevor Dame posted about Orange Cassidy, the point wasn't about, oh, Orange Cassidy's still on TV, he's fine. Well, he's in a throwaway tag team with Hook, who didn't win the match and aren't going for the tag team titles because they wanted him on the pay-per-view, but he's not in anything that's going to push him to the next level or ride that momentum to make him into a main eventer. And yes, he's an up and mid-carder that can step up into that position, but you want people eventually to lead that company and draw money. And, you know, I think it goes up and down the card, because there's been quite a lot of that in the last couple of years, and I think that's kind of why it resonates, is that it's happened so much. So even at lower levels, so Willow Nightingale, good example, won the Owen Hart
Cup.
Disappeared. Yeah. you know, that's the one kind of a lot of people talk about as of late. But then you've got the other ones in the last year, you know, you've got Wardlow. Okay, fair enough. The one that isn't, that everybody says, because he says it, is Ricky Starks, right? So, you're going to laugh at me for this one, I know. But you can say, you know, people say, oh, he's not winning. Okay, but in terms of consistent TV time and level of opponent, he's gone from MJF to Chris Jericho, which is guaranteed TV time every week, and winning twice over Chris Jericho. Funny enough, Chris Jericho is the guy that's put him over most in this lineup, which is quite funny. Then straight into the stuff with CM Punk for the whole summer. And then straight into Bryan Danielson. Find me anybody else who has had kind of that level of opponent, and probably, you know, and John Moxley probably coming soon. So yeah. That level of opponent for this amount of time. So he keeps saying, you know, he's undervalued, da, da, da. He's got far more TV time and opportunities than a lot of people this year at a similar level.
Right. Well, that's the part with and I, you know, Ricky Starks is definitely somebody that I was talking about when it came to the promotion, the promos and how they talk about, you know, I'm not given an opportunity, I'm not given a chance. And it's, there comes a point where it's like, I'm looking at you in main events on television every week. How are you not being given a chance? Like, you know, I genuinely don't understand this mindset. And, you know, I think there's that subset sometimes of fans who are like, if, you know, and I do think this is a WWE thing. If he's not winning the title, then there's, this isn't a push, right? If he doesn't have a belt, he isn't being pushed. And I think, you know, you can contrast that with someone like Swerve and Hangman, right? Who were in a non-title singles match on this pay-per-view, and both of them, regardless of who had won, and I think Swerve needed that win more than Hangman did. I'm glad Swerve got that win. But both of them elevated the hell out of themselves with their promos, with their in-ring work, with the match itself. And I think that, to me, I'm like, these guys get it, you know? And it makes me want to see a Hangman match or a Swerve match more than a Ricky Starks match. And, you know, you had that again last night where you had Yuta was definitely trying his everything, but that match had no heat, you know?
Yeah, it was completely visible. You know, yeah. Just if you want to talk about reactions, you can see that literally that has everything, because they've built it, it's been strong throughout, and they're willing to work together. I think it was quite clear that they worked together and are able to elevate each other.
Yes.
You know, they did a promo, it's Hangman easy could have said certain things or some cutbacks. No, because they knew what the reactions were going to be in Seattle and they played into that. Right. He's pretty good at playing into that role more than people think he is. But yeah, you know, and it's funny because when it comes to Hangman, you know, somebody said to us, one of our friends said that, you know, a lot of the kind of, when we talk about momentum and that, a lot of it probably comes back to him, and that's probably fair.
Yeah.
You know, because we spent so much time investing in him in the first 3-4 years of the company, that then when they failed to kind of convert him, and I don't think they've converted him to a main eventer completely. I don't think that's been, you know, other people can disagree on that. But I just think that he lost momentum so much after that, because they didn't move him sideways. They just kind of cycled him down and out of view. And now he's starting to kind of pick momentum back up, but you still need to convert that. So maybe that is kind of a key thing, is that, you know, they need to convert one or two to just kind of give people faith in back, in that if you invest in someone, that they are going to kind of carry that momentum. And for the wrestlers in the company as well, because it is complained about in the company. They do worry, sure, that there won't be follow-up when you kind of get hot. And the Acclaimed is probably the other one as well.
For me, with the Acclaimed right now, the focus being on Billy Gunn is sort of perplexing. I think I, at some point, expected that to dissipate. And, you know, I think that's one of the few areas where I would say I like Billy Gunn a lot. I don't know that I would be building hot tags around him at this point. But what can I tell you?
And that's kind of the balance that we talked about with Edge at the start, is that you've got to get that balance between, we used this guy and he was a legend here, or he was, you know, a star here, and Billy Gunn wasn't really a star there, but he's that kind of, that legendary kind of figure in that group, but it needs to be used to elevate those others, so they are the focal point. And if that's not how it ends up, then you're not succeeding with it. So it's a hard balance, so it's not easy. You know, we talk about these things like, oh, they can just be easily solved. But it's so much to balance. And, you know, yeah, things are more positive. I think you could see that there's more of a team ethos, something that's kind of been missing in the kind of the development for this pay-per-view. And then also in the press scrum afterwards. And, you know, that does give us hope that the kind of there will be this kind of build going forward.
You know what went such a long way on that for me was having Moxley do commentary for as many matches as he did. And I'm really excited for you to hear a lot of this, Trish, because I feel like you're going to get such a kick out of it. Like, there's something about his unrelenting enthusiasm and the unique way he has of expressing that unrelenting enthusiasm that was such a... And again, it's so weird to say this about Jon Moxley because he spent so long in WWE. It was such a specific AEW thing to me that, like, Jon Moxley is just at ringside screaming, fucking get him! Like, standing up and applauding and just, you know, I thought that was as much as any of the actual wrestling that kind of made the pay-per-view feel fun, you know? And I think that's the thing about AEW in the last month, pretty much since All In, is that it just feels fun again. You know, we talked about that a little bit last time, like that sort of sense of fun is back. And I do think there's things that I would like to be different or things that I could pick on and say, you know, this isn't great and this needs to be fixed. But if they can keep this sense of fun going, then I think that more than anything else will help bring a momentum back to the promotion.
And if you think about AEW in the kind of the first 6 to 12 months it existed, it had this really cool mix of kind of those fun elements and then also kind of the kind of deeper storytelling in the characters. I kind of compare it to, you know, we live in kind of a very kind of, not clickbait culture, but people like kind of information fast. So they'll, you know, some people just take one song from a record or something. Other people will play the whole record as a whole by the vinyl these days. So we kind of have this mixture in audience and kind of what they're looking for. And if you can kind of get the right blend and mix of that, you don't need to make everybody WWE cartoon one-dimensional characters. You also don't need everybody to be incredibly deep or have, you know, 3 or 4 different kind of major elements to each story. You just want a mix of everything. What's right. the Kenny thing? He says it's kind of... But he talks about how much AEW set out at the beginning to be kind of a mixture of professional wrestling and not just kind of one style imitating someone else. And I think that's kind of really important. But yeah, it does feel fun again. And there isn't this kind of pressure over it. That the press scrum last night, you know, there wasn't really any negativity at all.
No.
There was no kind of questions about what's going on backstage, no questions about someone's future, who gets on this, who does that. You know, there was, yeah, okay, one question about Jade. But that was kind of balanced out against this huge section, you know, and everybody, not just him himself, but all the other wrestlers talking about the arrival of Edge and how kind of important and excited they were. And there was that excitement amongst them as well. So it's not just us, but they were feeling that. And I think right. that's really important going forward.
Right. Right. And I think, listen, even the question about Jade, like we talked about this a little bit last week, it still was a positive question, you know? Like, we couldn't come to terms, but we wish her best and hopefully she'll come back here at some point. Like, that's what you, and by all accounts, the way that Edge left WWE, where they said, we wish him the best, we would have liked to have renewed him, hopefully he does well over there. Like, that is, and we talked about this last week, that is what you want out of professional wrestling in terms of a healthy work environment and, you know, a healthy business. So that topic actually, I think, leads us into our next topic, which goes from supportive work environments to the WWE merger with Endeavor and some of the resulting things that happened afterwards. So as announced, WWE and Endeavor merged on Tuesday, September 12th, and they started trading on the stock market as TKO, and they had the giant UFC belts outside of the stock exchange, and they had a bunch of people there, including Vince McMahon and Dana White and Triple H, so that was fascinating. They had massive office layoffs for WWE. It was about 100 people that were let go on Friday, the 15th of September, a few days later. And then the following week, on Thursday, September 21st, TKO announced a deal with USA Network, NBC Universal, for SmackDown. So it's a 5-year deal for SmackDown. It's $1.4 billion for 5 years of SmackDown on USA Network, plus 4 primetime specials on NBC, 4 primetime specials a year. So that's 56 shows a year on both USA and NBC. But the stock price of TKO dropped about 20% the first day because the expectation from the street, as it were, was that they were going to get $1.5 billion. And on top of that, Fox did not really seem to bid or want to bid for SmackDown on Fridays. So that's part of why the stock dropped. It has not rebounded. It's still pretty low in comparison. It's down to like $85 a share. There's conflicting reports on whether USA is expected to bid for NXT and Raw. Fox is out. Supposedly Amazon is still in. There's some interesting reports about that. And on the 21st, not long after the news broke about the SmackDown deal, WWE started with releases. They released about, I think it was about 20 or so wrestlers. Some of the bigger names were Dolph Ziggler, Shelton Benjamin, Rick Boogs, Elias, Riddick Moss, Mustafa Ali, Dana Brooke, Aaliyah, and a bunch of other wrestlers and some of the NIL candidates. And it seemed like in a lot of cases, these were wrestlers who were making main roster money, but they were not currently on the main roster. So it was kind of interesting because Ziggler seemed to know that the release was coming, but Mustafa Ali had a pay-per-view match scheduled for an NXT pay-per-view like 2 weeks later. So it seemed clear that was not something people were aware of. So, and then obviously the next day, Friday, the 22nd, Matt Riddle was also released. But that seems to be not as much about money as about other things. So, what do you think about this merger, Trish? This is big news.
Yeah. So I think the big thing when it comes to TKO is that you have a very much a profit efficiency between UFC and WWE. So WWE actually makes kind of more gross income than UFC, but makes a lot less profit. So we're going to see lots of kind of efforts to either drive profit. So we've seen with kind of the localized kind of shows being paid for by local government. So Elimination Chamber in Australia, that sort of thing to drive income is going to increase. But also, you know, TV rights, as we're talking about here, and then the kind of the cutting of costs, the cutting back on people. So, you know, they've seen this with UFC. So in UFC, they said, oh, there won't be any kind of cost cutting of fighters, or there won't be kind of cost cutting of kind of backroom staff that have been here for a long time. And then both happened.
Yeah.
And this will be the same in WWE now. So if they do not need you, they are not going to keep you. The days of kind of stock keeping wrestlers that we were doing in 2019, 2020 to keep them from AEW,
yep,
that's done. In fact, they realized when they flooded the market and put everybody into AEW that that caused far more issues than kind of keeping people from going to AEW. In terms of the, you know, the big news this week was the SmackDown deal. And you said it was $1.4 billion across the 5 years. But the interesting thing about that is that $287 million a year is not what they receive each year. It actually increases as the deal progresses. So, for example, in 2019, they received $177 million. And then it goes up by 7.5% each year. And this is similar for the AEW deals that are in place over the last few years as well. So what they receive in 2024 is going to be much more than what they received in this year.
Yes.
And, you know, for SmackDown, you know, in 2024, the fifth year of their deal, they're going to be at $238 million for that year. So the annual value of the deal that they had previously was $205. And if you continued, so if you continued the current rate, so from the current kind of $236 million, you at 7.5%, you're actually going to get pretty much exactly the same deal of, with that accrual that they now have with USA. So you could argue that rather than being an increase that was promised by Nick Khan of, you know, when he said 1.5 to 1.7, is actually a continuation of the current deal at that rate. And I think, you know, that's part of the reason why the market crashed kind of in terms of their share price the way it did. So it's not that he just didn't promise that, it's just, it's more of the same. So if you're buying into an increase and you're buying into that in the share price, then it will do that to you. And, you know, there's other issues with moving like they are. So Fox gives them, you know, a huge viewership because it's on linear television, yes, it's free to air. And also, they give them so much promotion. So they're promoted, yep, you know, on the NFL every Sunday, you know, biggest TV audience out there. You're going to lose that. And then you are going to go on to cable. They, you know, I know the press release said they'll keep it on Friday. But, yeah, there's a possibility you can move it. Surely other days will be kind of more valuable than Friday. Even Thursday or Tuesday could be more valuable. There's no reason why you couldn't move it to Monday and cause, you know, call it basically make it new Raw in their traditional, yeah, slot, if they were to lose Raw, or Raw was to go elsewhere. But the other thing is with that as well is that what they're looking for out of that is consistency. So it doesn't, right, necessarily matter to them kind of if it can't deliver the numbers that SmackDown was doing on Fox, because they get that consistency of that rating all year. You know, in terms of value, you've got to measure value in different ways. So you've got huge contracts increasing for a number of different kind of organizations, whether it's the Big Ten, whether it's Formula One, whether it's MLS on Apple. So then you're measuring, does that rate of increase then help those cable networks? And, you know, we know how kind of important Raw is to USA Network because it does so much higher than any other program. It drags up their average. It drags up probably their cable fees to providers. So you are probably getting similar numbers by doing that with SmackDown without having to pay or get into a bidding war for Raw. Do you think, so I know Nick Khan says that USA and NBC kind of are still in the market for Monday Night Raw. Do you think they are?
I don't know. The one thing I found fascinating was Meltzer reported that USA, NBC Universal has a right to match any deal, right? So if Fox comes in and says, or WBD or somebody comes in and says, we'll give you $250 million a year for Raw and NXT, NBCU has the ability to come in and say, we'll also give you $250 million a year. So that, I think, is fascinating. And I feel like there's been conflicting reports on whether NBC is out or are not out. And I also feel like if you're NBC Universal, do you want WWE to think that you still want the product? Or do you want them to kind of come back because, you know, you're spending a lot of money? And one of the things that gets brought up quite frequently is why they just didn't outright buy WWE 5 years ago, as opposed to continually reinvesting billions of dollars. They could have probably paid $3 billion and owned the damn thing. So I don't know. My gut says they're probably still in it. But I also, you know, the TV rights thing is changing so rapidly and is so impacted by the decline of cable and the lack of profit in streaming that this is a tough one. Like I said, my gut says yes, but I don't feel confident in my gut on this one.
And the interesting thing there is, you know, they could have possibly even bought WWE this year. You know, they have the pay-per-views and the library on Peacock, which is losing a ton of money. Has to be said, you're right on that. You have NXT and Raw on USA. So if you were to add SmackDown, you know, why wouldn't you just buy the whole thing now? That's probably an interesting question because they're probably across the that period of time going to pay more out for the TV rights if they did acquire Raw as well as SmackDown. That's probably why I'm kind of in the opposite. And I'm not too surprised that Fox kind of didn't keep them because, you know, they said, you know, because it's free-to-air, the ad rates are higher in general and to air on that network. Whereas, so, you know, they were finding the SmackDown just wasn't earning that kind of ad rate to match the investment they put in. So, for example, in 2020 to 2021, in that season, Fox paid $198.7 million for SmackDown, but only made, well, didn't even make, they lost $134 million during that period. So, you know, you can look at the SmackDown numbers in 2021 to 2022, still the same, underperforming what they expected. Because when they got SmackDown on Fox, you know, they were talking about 1.0s in the demo. And now you can look at when they do kind of 0.7s to 0.8s and say with the decline in cable, that's probably matching what was expected in that deal. But that didn't happen until right at the end. So the first 4 years under, you know, first 3 years, 3.5 years, underperformed. And you're looking at the numbers now and SmackDown is starting to kind of fall backwards into a bit more of a trend. There is more competition as we go into the fall. But for them, you know, you can put Big Ten, you can put college football in that slot and earn far more in ad revenue. You know, we saw it with NHL, with Dynamite. People couldn't understand why that move was made when they went to TBS. And it was because, you know, the NHL was getting more priority on TNT. And it's because even though less people were watching, it was driving higher ad revenue.
It's such a fascinating, you know, because obviously Nick Khan, and it was such a big deal about, you know, in the press release, they mentioned WBD is still possibly being, you know, one of the places that could take Raw and NXT, which I find fascinating and almost wanted to have happen just from a chaos demon perspective of like, let's see if they can, the true can they coexist moment. But I think one of the things that has gotten talked about, and I think Brandon Thurston is the person who first started discussing this years ago, was the value for money from AEW in terms of you're paying a premium for you know, WWE programming, and are you getting the return on it that you could get, you know, 75% of the return on WWE programming from AEW for 50% of the cost, maybe, right? And that would still be considered a huge win for AEW because it would be a giant increase over what they're currently making. It's such a... The whole thing is, in, you know, and in terms of, like, what show moves what night, they're probably not going to want to keep SmackDown on Fridays. Where does it go? And if does that impact does that impact AEW? Do they decide to drop it on Wednesdays? Do they move it to Tuesdays? Like, I think there's so many moving parts to this that it's really... No, go ahead.
It's like tectonic plates, isn't it?
You move one
and then the rest move, right? And you know what? There's some kind of interesting things going on with AEW that kind of I wonder if they're doing trial runs to see what it's like. So if you look at when these collision tapings are being moved about to, so we've got some Friday night tapings.
Yep.
We've also in Montreal, and this was because the building availability and it was easy to do two nights, you've got a Tuesday night taping. But actually, you can kind of do this as a dry run and just see what it's like logistically for them to do this, just in case, you know, these things need to happen.
And I think it is, like you said, it is tectonic plates. It does have such a huge impact on, you know, what happens and how it goes. And, you know, the other thing that's a big piece of this is the amount of debt that Endeavor is currently carrying from the purchase of UFC and how that's going to be impacted by the stock price and how those rights deals are so important, you know, just in terms of their ability to stay ahead of that debt load, which was something that got brought up as a reason why they wouldn't be in the running to purchase WWE in the first place.
Yeah, and, you know, there's some other things that are kind of on the side that have an impact on this. So the NBA rights deal being up.
Yep.
The year after next, which will be negotiated next year, is playing in. And we've just seen an announcement today that there, and I know some of this is to do with the strikes, but there will be 5 NBA games on ABC in January. So then if you have kind of the NBA increasing its value and moving more to linear, that's going to change that kind of marketplace as well. And then, you know, streaming is so fun with this in terms of trying to work out the impact, because, you know, is streaming going to hold in terms of its current model? Or are we going to be end up one day with just kind of Apple, Google, and Amazon? You know, that's kind of how it feels. But when you look at, you know, Amazon Prime is doing kind of $30 million now for Thursday Night Football. Right. Nobody thought that was going to work. It's quite successful. Over here, you know, they have Premier League fixtures around the Christmas period. So they are taking kind of prime targets and being able to take them across there. Yeah, the big thing, if Amazon were to get Monday Night Raw or whatever they want to call it, you know, the thing is, you want huge money to take it off kind of regular television, but then also you've got to look at what's the impact when you come up to your next TV rights deal. Does it affect your kind of your visibility, so therefore kind of your live business as well? And yes, you know, we've all talked about live ticketing not making or being the kind of major source of income. But you've also got to look at your future investments. And we don't know what streaming is going to be. We don't know what TV is going to be. And it's that uncertainty that kind of makes everything so interesting.
But this is where my uneducated, not business school going, but comes into play here, right? Because, you know, obviously the understanding from a publicly traded company is that your obligation to the stockholders is to take the best deal possible. So if Amazon comes on in and says, we'll offer you $50 million more a year, or $100 million more a year, whatever, to come to Amazon, there's more pressure on WWE to take that deal, which may ultimately, as you said, not be better for them in the long term. It may be a good short-term deal that may raise their you know, stock price, but from a long-term perspective, it may hurt them with live audiences, with the perspective of them existing within the marketplace. Whereas a non-publicly traded company like AEW has the ability to turn that deal down if they don't think it works for them long-term. That's the kind of stuff that I find so interesting in all of this in terms of, you know, in some ways, WWE is handcuffed a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they have to do what's right for their shareholders and to service that debt. And, right. You know, there's a couple of interesting things in terms of this. So there is some kind of hedging going on. So Max is like a prime example. So you're looking at Max doing the kind of the sports tier behind kind of which is a second tier to the current entertainment tier, but will broadcast the same content as what it does on cable television. So you are replicating rather than providing kind of exclusive content. So
and they
you
were very
can then
clear.
Measure.
Yeah, no, they were very clear. They didn't want to cannibalize their existing cable service. They were very much like, we don't want to take away our cable viewers and only replace it with straight. But at this part, I'm glad you brought this up. This part I also find fascinating.
Yeah, and you've also got the introduction of adverts coming into Amazon Prime next year. So are you just replacing cable systems with now with streaming systems in a way that you weren't doing previously? You know, how does this affect kind of the carrier fees for cable networks if some of this material is now available for, you know, if you were just in, you know, say you just wanted the college basketball, like the March Madness, you are paying that subscription, that $25.99 or whatever it may become is going to be less than what you'd pay for cable.
Yep.
So are you therefore making your content and the carriage of your content with TBS, with TNT, cheaper? Does that need to come down? Are the cable companies going to pay it? So there's so much uncertainty. And it's why it's probably, you know, very important these deals are done as quick as possible for both companies. And I do wonder, you know, if it's in, if the kind of, not the devaluation of SmackDown, because you remember I was reading an old... It sounds so weird. I read an old Observer from 2003 the other day, and something I've been working on. And they were talking about the quarterly income from TSN and is it USA or is it UPN? I'm not sure which the American network was, but the American network and the Canadian network combined for that quarter was $11 million a year. We're now at a point where one show is doing in just the US. Can do $287 million a year across 5 years on average. So the amount that they have increased is just, you know, and expanded in 20 years. 20 years is huge. But you do have to wonder, does that bubble burst? How does these kind of changes in the way people are consuming content now match or not match kind of the amounts being paid? And we've seen, you know, people talked about it with kind of local networks going bust and struggling and how that's affecting kind of Major League Baseball. It does feel like there must be a breaking point somewhere. People can't keep sinking money into things that are not profitable. So what is that line? I just find it's completely fascinating. And, you know, when it comes to talent as well, so what you do see with UFC, and I think you will see more of with WWE, is... they will release people they don't want, but they will also not pay people that are up to the value that they perceive them at.
Yes.
You know, they've had a former heavyweight champion who is boxing Tyson Fury.
Yes.
In 3 weeks because, you know, they didn't see his value of $500,000 a fight matching 300,000 buys when they can bring in John Jones and him do 600 to 800,000 buys.
Yes.
So they will pay for people they think of value. You know, people talk about Punk. Yeah, they pay for Punk just like UFC pay for Conor McGregor. If they think there's value in somebody, they will pay, but they're not going to overpay to keep you if they don't think you have enough value to drive that profit for them.
Right. I don't think we've seen the last of the releases from WWE. I think there will definitely be more. But I do think, like you said, they'll be very strategic. And it was one of those things that, as much as, you know, once... they sort of went with the rationale of, like, these are people we're paying a lot of money to that we're not using. It kind of made sense, right? You know, I mean, how much value are they getting out of a Dana Brooke or, you know, a Shelton Benjamin and, you know, when they could probably pay a Grayson Waller a third of what that guy's making, right? So I think from a talent perspective, there's a couple of interesting people here. You know, I think my hope is that as much as WWE has learned its lesson about talent hoarding, AEW has learned its lesson about hiring everyone. Anyone with a WWE somewhere on their resume is immediately, you know. I think there's some people here that I wouldn't be opposed to coming in, but, you know, I don't know that I look at anybody that got released and say, oh, they are a must-have, from my perspective anyway.
I think Shelton Benjamin will come in as a producer. I think that's a... kind of unkempt secret, I think, at this point.
Yeah.
The only, you know, Ziggler can come in and do something short program. He's, you know, he's quite useful for that. But you wouldn't want to, you know, they're making a long-term, kind of a longer-term investment in Edge. I'd be even less likely to do that with Ziggler. To me, the most interesting name is kind of Mustafa Ali. Now, he's 37. Yes. But he is a natural babyface that can cut babyface promos, who is also from Chicago and of Pakistani origin. Now, we might forget, but Tony Khan from Chicago, I think he'd be kind of a natural fit, and he's very good in the ring, good at developing, and a favourite of Bryan Danielson in the past, who really wanted to work with him. So I would not be surprised in that. I think he has probably the highest upside. And
I think that's expand 100%
in markets. Yeah. He can be the new Chicago guy, right? He can just sell all his shirts in Chicago.
What are you talking about? what do you mean? We've never had a Chicago guy. What are you? I think
I'm missing something. Yeah,
I think Ali is definitely the most likely one to come in. I agree with that, and I think, like you said, I think Shelton Benjamin. I don't know that there's anybody else. You know, I think that Ryan Nemeth is great, and I would not be opposed to a, you know, Nemeth brothers little tag team run. Not necessarily wins or anything like that, but something stupid could be kind of funny and enjoyable. And you know how much I love funny and enjoyable and stupid. literally 90% of what I watch wrestling for. So that's the kind of stuff that I'm like, as with anything, I am open to any of it as long as it's interesting and different, you know, and I think that's kind of where I stand with any of these. I obviously, you know, some I'm like, no, but I think those are fairly obvious.
Yeah, it's just changeable times. So there's a lot of contracts coming up in 2024. You know, people are now talking openly about Becky Lynch, and she's done nothing to hurt her value in recent months. People are talking quite openly about kind of Ricky Starks on the other side potentially being up kind of September next year. There's even talk, you know, at the end of the year, that QT Marshall might not be with AEW, and that kind of a sea change in how they do things creatively. So, you know, and I'm sure there's LA Knight. I'm sure there's plenty of others as well that we aren't aware of who keep things quieter that will come up next year. So with all these kind of TV deals and all the kind of talent deals and, yeah, the need for TKO to service their debt and also to keep, you know, bad press off, there's that huge lawsuit around fighters' pay still outstanding. There's a reason why with the Jay Cargill kind of publicity release, they kept away from mentioning Vince McMahon, because, you know, we saw the new LA Times article last week on him. There's still things outstanding there. So there's so many factors kind of coming into play that means it is going to be quite a move kind of. It's like tectonic plates again. It's like everything is going to be moving continuously. There's going to be all sorts of little games sort of thing. And, you know, at the same time, they've both, AEW and WWE, have got to focus on that kind of that product and progressing people through, and kind of for WWE, keeping that momentum, for AEW, kind of gaining it back.
I do think AEW has done a good job this year of locking down most of their top talent. And it does seem like there was a period of time where there were more potential AEW free agents, and that balance has shifted back to WWE. That it's a bigger contract year in 2024 for WWE free agents than it is for AEW. Now, that said, there's probably people we don't know anything about what's going on with them. There's people in AEW and WWE who keep their, to borrow a phrase, to keep their shit on lock. So, you know, they're not saying a lot, but I think it does seem pretty clear that Tony has prioritized some people and made some commitments. And, you know, I think your top of the card people, with the exception of Danielson, and that's sort of up in the air right now in terms of what he's going to do with his future, those people are all pretty much locked down into long-term contracts.
And, you know, the thing we talked about with kind of Max, and we talked about momentum. So there is huge opportunities coming in AEW in the next year that haven't been there maybe for time and space previously. So Danielson, if he goes to just doing the occasional match, well, that's a huge gap with Collision that you're going to need to fit, and you're going to have to put somebody else into that spot. And also, you know, Omega can't wrestle every week anymore. You can't do that kind of thing. So they have become special attractions. So you need people to kind of step up and fill that void. So there will be increased opportunities, never mind, you know, that are not tied up with the world title and Max, depending what they choose to do with it. So that's another thing that we probably don't pay much attention to, because it feels so long away, and everything's been so changeable in the last 6 months, and so many different kind of outcomes. But there is a need now to get people to that level for progression, to kind of hold these spots in future, to kind of come up with a guide and not replace Kenny Omega, but can perform, you know, in a similar way in much more often. And the same, you know, I don't know how you replace Brian Danielson, but you need a guy that can go in and elevate everybody and work that kind of style and deliver every week. And they potentially do have that on the roster.
Yes.
But now's the time to kind of get that in place.
I think there's also, and we talked about this a little bit last week, there's potential new Japan free agents coming in. And I think, you know, that is the benefit that AEW has over WWE, is that if you're not sure about going from New Japan, you know, some of these people will have experience working with AEW. They will feel comfortable in AEW. And if AEW offers them as much money and gives them the opportunities to go work with New Japan or stay with New Japan, which I think a lot of folks have you saw Kenny talking about it this week in terms of his commitment to Japan and how much he felt like that was a home to him and how important it was for him to be able to still work there. You know, that's a huge selling point for specific free agents. And I think, you know, the benefit of Collision, the benefit of the added time is that it's like, let's give some people some opportunities. Let's give some people who have not been on television some opportunities. Let's see what they make of those opportunities. And maybe it'll be obvious to us what's successful, and maybe it won't be obvious to us who's successful. I think there's a lot to be positive about. And we said this before, but I think there's just a lot. There's certain things that need to get cleaned up or fixed or whatever, but it just overall, things seem to be in a better position for AEW than they have been in a while. And, you know, I don't think things are bad for WWE per se, but maybe more in flux than they have been in the last year.
They've certainly got more challenge than they had coming into this year. You know, they came in with so much momentum with the Bloodline thing, Sami Zayn getting hot, Cody Rhodes coming back and being hot, you know, the increase in ticketing in their attendances numbers. So they've had that kind of momentum going through, and now they have different challenges to kind of navigate and negotiate. And, you know, you have to say as much, they're in a really interesting place now as well, because their live attendance is huge. But in terms of momentum, it does feel like something has kind of shifted since SummerSlam, particularly with their PLEs. So how that plays into, and yeah, they have WrestleMania season and that's an instant bump. But how that plays into the remainder of part of this year and the early part of next year is key as well. So yeah, we're in interesting times.
We really are. What a great time to start a podcast.
We've managed two episodes. That's not a bad stop.
Probably a good place to end one, right? I think that's a decent stopping place for us this week.
Once again, thank you for everybody that listened to our first episode. Thank you if you've come back and joined us all the way through to this point in our second episode. Something that was brought up to us last week and I shamefully missed because I am still slightly amateur at this, is that if you do have any questions, whether it be about the data, about the subjects we've discussed, or just want to give us some feedback, you can email us at trishandsarahpod@gmail.com. That's trishandsarahpod@gmail.com. We will either reply personally, or for a wider subject, we may bring it into future podcasts for all of you to hear a discussion on said topic. So yeah, please feedback anything that you wish to. This has been the second episode of the Trish and Sarah Pod. We are produced by the wonderful Leah of Tunnel Talk, and I said it last week and I'll say it again, one of the best look into any character's stories in AEW, an absolute highlight of my weekend on a weekly basis. This has been the Trish and Sarah Pod. This is a thank you from Trish.
And a thank you from Sarah.
We will see you in 2 weeks.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. TNCs apply.